When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 31 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Ozy, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in March 2008. Chapter 31. Final Dispositions. To Chauvelin the day had been one of restless inquietude and nervous apprehension. Collot d'Herbois harassed him with questions and complaints intermixed with threats but thinly veiled. At his suggestion Gayole had been transformed into a fully manned, well-garrisoned fortress. Troops were to be seen everywhere, on the stairs and in the passages, the guard-rooms and offices. Picked men from the municipal guard, and the company which had been sent down from Paris some time ago. Chauvelin had not resisted these orders given by his colleague. He knew quite well that Marguerite would make no attempt at escape, but he had long ago given up all hope of persuading a man of the type of Collot d'Herbois that a woman of her temperament would never think of saving her own life at the expense of others, and that Sir Percy Blakeney, in spite of his adoration for his wife, would sooner see her die before him than allow the lives of innocent men and women to be the price of hers. Collot was one of those brutish sorts, not by any means infrequent among the terrorists of that time, who, born in the gutter, still loved to wallow in his native element, and who measured all his fellow creatures by the same standard which he had always found good enough for himself. In this man there was neither the enthusiastic patriotism of a Chauvelin, nor the ardent selflessness of a Danton. He served the revolution and fostered the anarchical spirit of the times only because those brought him a competence and a notoriety which an orderly and fastidious government would obviously have never offered him. History shows no more despicable personality than that of Collot d'Herbois, one of the most hideous products of that utopian revolution, whose grandly conceived theories of a universal levelling of mankind only succeeded in dragging into prominence a number of half-brutish creatures who, revelling in their own abasement, would otherwise have remained content in inglorious obscurity. Chauvelin tolerated and half-feared Collot, knowing full well that if now the Scarlet Pimpernel escaped from his hands, he could expect no mercy from his colleagues. The scheme by which he hoped to destroy not only the heroic leader but the entire League, by bringing opprobrium and ridicule upon them, was wonderfully subtle in its refined cruelty, and Chauvelin, knowing by now something of Sir Percy Blakeney's curiously blended character, was never for a moment in doubt but that he would write the infamous letter, save his wife by sacrificing his honour, and then seek oblivion and peace in suicide. With so much disgrace, so much mud cast upon their chief, the League of the Scarlet Pimpernel would cease to be. That had been Chauvelin's plan all along. For the end he had schemed and thought and planned from the moment that Robespierre had given him the opportunity of redeeming his failure of last year. He had built up the edifice of his intrigue bit by bit, from the introduction of his tool Candet to Marguerite at the Richmond Gala, to the arrest of Lady Blakeney in Boulogne. All that remained for him to see now would be the attitude of Sir Percy Blakeney tonight, when in exchange for the stipulated letter he would see his wife set free. All day Chauvelin had wondered how it would all go off. He had stage-managed everything, but he did not know how the chief actor would play his part. From time to time, when his feeling of restlessness became quite unendurable, the ex-ambassador would wander round Fort Gayole and, on some pretext or other, demand to see one or the other of his prisoners. Marguerite, however, observed complete silence in his presence. She acknowledged his greeting with a slight inclination of the head, and in reply to certain perfunctory queries of his, which he put to her in order to justify his appearance, she either nodded or gave curt monosyllabic answers through partially closed lips. "I trust that everything is arranged for your comfort, Lady Blakeney." "I thank you, sir." "You will be rejoining the Daydream tonight. Can I send a messenger over to the yacht for you?"
"I thank you, no."
"Sir Percy is well. He is fast asleep and hath not asked for your ladyship. Shall I let him know that you are well?" A nod of acquiescence from Marguerite and Chauvelin's string of queries was at an end. He marvelled at her quietude, and thought that she should have been as restless as himself. Later on in the day, and egged on by Collot d'Herbois and by his own fears, he had caused Marguerite to be removed from number 6. This change he heralded by another brief visit to her, and his attitude this time was one of deferential apology. "A matter of expediency, Lady Blakeney," he explained, "and I trust that the change will be for your comfort." Again the same curt nod of acquiescence on her part, and a brief, "As you command, monsieur." But when he had gone, she turned with a sudden passionate outburst towards the Abbé Fouquet, her faithful companion through the past long, weary hours. She fell on her knees beside him and sobbed in an agony of grief. "Oh, if I could only know, if I could only see him for a minute, a second, if I could only know!" She felt as if the awful uncertainty would drive her mad. If she could only know, if she could only know what he meant to do! "The good God knows," said the old man, with his usual simple philosophy, "and perhaps it is all for the best." The room which Chauvelin had now destined for Marguerite was one which gave from the larger one wherein last night he had had his momentous interview with her and with Sir Percy. It was small, square, and dark, with no window in it, only a small ventilating hole high up in the wall and heavily grated. Chauvelin, who desired to prove to her that there was no wish on his part to add physical discomfort to her mental tortures, had given orders that the little place should be made as habitable as possible. A thick, soft carpet had been laid on the ground, there was an easy chair and a comfortable-looking couch with a couple of pillows and a rug on it, and, oh marvel, on the round central table, a vase with a huge bunch of many-coloured dahlias which seemed to throw a note as if of gladness into the strange and gloomy little room. At the furthest corner, too, a construction of iron uprights and crossway bars had been hastily contrived and fitted with curtains, forming a small recess, behind which was a tidy washstand, fine clean towels, and plenty of fresh water. Evidently the shops of Boulogne had been commandeered in order to render Marguerite's sojourn here outwardly agreeable. But as the place was innocent of window, so was it innocent of doors. The one that gave into the large room had been taken out of its hinges, leaving only the frame, on each side of which stood a man from the municipal guard with fixed bayonet. Chauvelin himself had conducted Marguerite to her new prison. She followed him, silent and apathetic, with not a trace of that awful torrent of emotion which had overwhelmed her but half an hour ago, when she had fallen on her knees beside the old priest and sobbed her heart out in a passionate fit of weeping. Even the sight of the soldiers left her outwardly indifferent. As she stepped across the threshold, she noticed that the door itself had been taken away. Then she gave another quick glance at the soldiers, whose presence there would control her every movement. The thought of Queen Marie Antoinette in the Conciergerie prison, with the daily, hourly humiliation and shame which this constant watch imposed upon her womanly pride and modesty, flashed suddenly across Marguerite's mind, and a deep blush of horror rapidly suffused her pale cheeks, whilst an almost imperceptible shudder shook her delicate frame. Perhaps, as in a flash, she had at this moment received an inkling of what the nature of that terrible either-or might be with which Chauvelin was trying to force an English gentleman to dishonour. Sir Percy Blakeney's wife had been threatened with Marie Antoinette's fate. "You see, madame," said her cruel enemy's unctuous voice close to her ear, "that we have tried our humble best to make your brief sojourn here as agreeable as possible. May I express a hope that you will be quite comfortable in this room until the time when Sir Percy will be ready to accompany you to the Daydream?" "I thank you, sir," she replied quietly. "And if there is anything you require, I pray you to call. I shall be in the next room all day and entirely at your service." A young orderly now entered, bearing a small collation, eggs, bread, milk, and wine, which he set on the central table. Chauvelin bowed low before Marguerite and withdrew. Anon he ordered the two sentinels to stand the other side of the doorway against the wall of his own room, and well out of sight of Marguerite, so that as she moved about her own narrow prison, if she ate or slept, she might have the illusion that she was unwatched. The sight of the soldiers had had the desired effect on her. Chauvelin had seen her shudder, and knew that she understood of that she guessed. He was now satisfied, and really had no wish to harass her beyond endurance. Moreover, there was always the proclamation which threatened the breadwinners of Boulogne with death if Marguerite Blakeney escaped, and which would be in full force until Sir Percy had written, signed, and delivered into Chauvelin's hands the letter which was to be the signal for the general amnesty. Chauvelin had indeed cause to be satisfied with his measures. There was no fear that his prisoners would attempt to escape. Even Collot d'Herbois had to admit everything was well done. He had read the draft of the proposed letter, and was satisfied with its contents. Gradually now into his loutish brain there had filtrated the conviction that Citizen Chauvelin was right, that that accursed Scarlet Pimpernel and his brood of English spies would be more effectually annihilated by all the dishonour and ridicule which such a letter written by the mysterious hero would heap upon them all, than they could ever be through the relentless work of the guillotine. His only anxiety now was whether the Englishman would write that letter. "Bah, he'll do it," he would say, whenever he thought the whole matter over. "Sacre tonnerre! But 'tis an easy means to save his own skin." "You would sign such a letter without hesitation, eh, Citizen Collot?" said Chauvelin, with well-concealed sarcasm, on one occasion when his colleague discussed the all-absorbing topic with him. "You would show no hesitation if your life were at stake, and you were given the choice between writing that letter and the guillotine?" "Parbleu!" responded Collot with conviction. "More especially," continued Chauvelin dryly, "if 1,000,000 francs were promised you as well." "Sacre anglais!" swore Collot angrily. "You don't propose giving him that money, do you?" "We'll place it ready to his hand, at any rate, so that it should appear as if he had actually taken it." Collot looked up at his colleague in ungrudging admiration. Chauvelin had indeed left nothing undone, had thought everything out in this strangely conceived scheme for the destruction of the enemy of France. "But in the name of all the dwellers in hell, citizen," admonished Collot, "guard that letter well once it is in your hands."
"I'll do better than that," said Chauvelin. "I will hand it over to you, Citizen Collot, and you shall ride with it to Paris at once."
"Tonight," assented Collot with a shout of triumph, as he brought his grimy fist crashing down on the table. "I'll have a horse ready saddled at this very gate and an escort of mounted men. We'll ride like hell's own furies and not pause to breathe until that letter is in Citizen Robespierre's hands."
"Well thought of, citizen," said Chauvelin approvingly. "I pray you give the necessary orders, that the horses be ready saddled, and the men booted and spurred, and waiting at the Gaillole gate at 7 o'clock this evening."
"I wish the letter were written and safely in our hands by now."
"Nay, the Englishman will have it ready by this evening, never fear. The tide is high at 7:30, and he will be in haste for his wife to be aboard his yacht ere the turn, even if he..." He paused, savouring the thoughts which had suddenly flashed across his mind, and a look of intense hatred and cruel satisfaction for a moment chased away the studied impassiveness of his face.
"What do you mean, citizen?"
queried Collot anxiously.
"Even if he—what?"
"Oh, nothing, nothing. I was only trying to make vague guesses as to what the Englishman will do after he has written the letter," quoth Chauvelin reflectively.
"Morbleu! He'll return to his own accursed country, glad enough to have escaped with his skin."
"I suppose," added Collot with sudden anxiety, "you have no fear that he will refuse at the last moment to write that letter?" The two men were sitting in the large room, out of which opened the one which was now occupied by Marguerite. They were talking at the further end of it, close to the window, and though Chauvelin had mostly spoken in a whisper, Collot had oft-times shouted, and the ex-ambassador was wondering how much Marguerite had heard. Now, at Collot's anxious query, he gave a quick, furtive glance in the direction of the further room wherein she sat, so silent and so still, that it seemed almost as if she must be sleeping.
"You don't think that the Englishman will refuse to write the letter?" insisted Collot with angry impatience.
"No," replied Chauvelin quietly.
"But if he does?"
persisted the other. "If he does, I send the woman to Paris tonight and have him hanged as a spy in this prison-yard without further formality or trial," replied Chauvelin firmly. "So either way you see, citizen," he added in a whisper, "the Scarlet Pimpernel is done for. But I think that he will write the letter."
"Parbleu, so do I," rejoined Collot with a coarse laugh.
End of chapter 31. Chapter 32 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in March 2008. Chapter 32. The Letter. Later on, when his colleague left him in order to see to the horses and to his escort for tonight, Chauvelin called Sergeant Herbert, his old and trusted familiar, to him, and gave him some final orders. "The Angelus must be rung at the proper hour, friend Herbert," he began with a grim smile.
"The Angelus, citizen?" quoth the sergeant with complete stupefaction. "'Tis months now since it has been rung. It was forbidden by a decree of the Convention, and I doubt me if any of our men would know how to set about it."
Chauvelin's eyes were fixed before him in apparent vacancy, while the same grim smile still hovered round his thin lips. Something of that irresponsible spirit of adventure which was the mainspring of all Sir Percy Blakeney's actions must for the moment have pervaded the mind of his deadly enemy. Chauvelin had thought out this idea of having the Angelus rung tonight, and was thoroughly pleased with the notion.
This was the day when the duel was to have been fought. 7 o'clock would have been the very hour, and the sound of the Angelus to have been the signal for combat, and there was something very satisfying in the thought that that same Angelus should be rung, as a signal that the Scarlet Pimpernel was withered and broken at last. In answer to Hebert's look of bewilderment, Chauvelin said quietly, "We must have some signal between ourselves and the guard at the different gates, also with the harbour officials. At a given moment the general amnesty must take effect and the harbour become a free port. I have a fancy that the signal shall be the ringing of the Angelus. The cannons at the gate and the harbour can boom in response, then the prisons can be thrown open and prisoners can either participate in the evening fete or leave the city immediately as they choose. The Committee of Public Safety has promised the amnesty. It will carry out its promise to the full, and when citizen Collot d'Herbois arrives in Paris with the joyful news, all natives of Boulogne and the prisons there will participate in the free pardon too."
"I understand all that, citizen," said Hebert, still somewhat bewildered, "but not the Angelus."
"A fancy, friend Hebert, and I mean to have it."
"But who is to ring it, citizen?"
"Morbleu, haven't you one Calotin left in Boulogne whom you can press into doing this service?"
"Aye, Calotin enough. There's the Abbé Fouquet in this very building, in number 6 cell."
"Sacre tonnerre!" ejaculated Chauvelin exultingly. "The very man! I know his dossier well. Once he is free he will make straight away for England, he and his family, and will help to spread the glorious news of the dishonour and disgrace of the much-vaunted Scarlet Pimpernel. The very man, friend Hebert! Let him be stationed here, to see the letter written, to see the money handed over, for we will go through with that farce. And make him understand that the moment I give him the order, he can run over to his old church St. Joseph and ring the Angelus. That old fool will be delighted, more especially when he knows that he will thereby be giving the very signal which will set his own sister's children free. You understand?"
"I understand, citizen."
"And you can make the old Calotin understand?"
"I think so, citizen. You want him in this room. At what time?"
"A 7:15.
"Yes, I'll bring him along myself and stand over him, lest he play any pranks."
"Oh, he'll not trouble you," sneered Chauvelin. "He'll be deeply interested in the proceedings. The woman will be here too, remember," he added with a jerky movement of the hand in the direction of Marguerite's room. "The two might be made to stand together, with 4 of your fellows round them."
"I understand, citizen. Are any of us to escort the citizen Fouquet when he goes to St. Joseph?"
"Aye, 2 men had best go with him. There will be a crowd in the streets by then. How far is it from here to the church?"
"Less than 5 minutes."
"Good. See to it that the doors are opened and the bell ropes easy of access."
"It shall be seen to, citizen. How many men will you have inside this room tonight?"
"Let the walls be lined with men whom you can trust. I anticipate neither trouble nor resistance. The whole thing is a simple formality to which the Englishman has already intimated his readiness to submit. If he changes his mind at the last moment, there will be no Angelus rung, no booming of the cannons or opening of the prison doors. There will be no amnesty and no free pardon. The woman will be at once conveyed to Paris and..."
"But he'll not change his mind, friend Hebert," he concluded in suddenly altered tones, and speaking quite lightly. "He'll not change his mind." The conversation between Chauvelin and his familiar had been carried on in whispers. Not that the terrorist cared whether Marguerite overheard or not, but whispering had become a habit with this man whose torturous ways and subtle intrigues did not lend themselves to discussion in a loud voice. Chauvelin was sitting at the central table, just where he had been last night when Sir Percy Blakeney's sudden advent broke in on his meditations. The table had been cleared of the litter of multitudinous papers which had encumbered it before. On it now there were only a couple of heavy pewter candlesticks with the tallow candles fixed ready in them, a leather pad, an inkwell, a sandbox, and 2 or 3 quill pens, everything disposed, in fact, for the writing and signing of the letter. Already in imagination, Chauvelin saw his impudent enemy, the bold and daring adventurer, standing there beside that table and putting his name to the consummation of his own infamy. The mental picture thus evoked brought a gleam of cruel satisfaction and of satisfied lust into the keen, ferret-like face, and a smile of intense joy lit up the narrow, pale-coloured eyes. He looked round the room where the great scene would be enacted. 2 soldiers were standing guard outside Marguerite's prison, 2 more at attention near the door which gave on the passage. His own 6 picked men were waiting his commands in the corridor. Presently the whole room would be lined with troops, himself and Collot standing with eyes fixed on the principal actor of the drama, Hebert with specially selected troopers standing guard over Marguerite. No, no, he had left nothing to chance this time, and down below the horses would be ready saddled that were to convey Collot and the precious document to Paris. No. Nothing was left to chance, and in either case he was bound to win.
Sir Percy Blakeney would either write the letter in order to save his wife and heap dishonour on himself, or he would shrink from the terrible ordeal at the last moment and let Chauvelin and the Committee of Public Safety work their will with her and him. In that case, the pillory as a spy and summary hanging for you, my friend, concluded Chauvelin in his mind, and for your wife? Bah, once you are out of the way, even she will cease to matter. He left Hebert on guard in the room. An irresistible desire seized him to go and have a look at his discomfited enemy, and from the latter's attitude make a shrewd guess as to what he meant to do tonight. Sir Percy had been given a room on one of the upper floors of the old prison. He had in no way been closely guarded, and the room itself had been made as comfortable as may be. He had seemed quite happy and contented when he had been conducted hither by Chauvelin the evening before. "I hope you quite understand, Sir Percy, that you are my guest here tonight," Chauvelin had said suavely, "and that you are free to come and go just as you please." "Lud love you, sir," Sir Percy had replied gaily, "but I verily believe that I am. It is only Lady Blakeney whom we have cause to watch until tomorrow," added Chauvelin with quiet significance. "Is that not so, Sir Percy?" But Sir Percy seemed, whenever his wife's name was mentioned, to lapse into irresistible somnolence. He yawned now with his usual affectation, and asked at what hour gentlemen in France were wont to breakfast. Since then Chauvelin had not seen him. He had repeatedly asked how the English prisoner was faring, and whether he seemed to be sleeping and eating heartily. The orderly in charge invariably reported that the Englishman seemed well, but did not eat much. On the other hand, he had ordered, and lavishly paid for, measure after measure of brandy, and bottle after bottle of wine. How strange these Englishmen are, mused Chauvelin. This so-called hero is nothing but a wine-sodden brute who seeks to nerve himself for a trying ordeal by drowning his faculties in brandy. Perhaps, after all, he doesn't care. But the wish to have a look at that strangely complex creature—hero, adventurer, or mere lucky fool—was irresistible, and Chauvelin, in the latter part of the afternoon, went up to the room which had been allotted to Sir Percy Blakeney. He never moved now without his escort, and this time also two of his favourite bodyguard accompanied him to the upper floor. He knocked at the door but received no answer, and after a second or two he bade his men wait in the corridor, and, gently turning the latch, walked in. There was an odour of brandy in the air. On the table two or three empty bottles of wine and a glass half filled with cognac testified to the truth of what the orderly had said, whilst sprawling across the camp bedstead, which obviously was too small for his long limbs, his head thrown back, his mouth open for a vigorous snore, lay the imperturbable Sir Percy fast asleep. Chauvelin went up to the bedstead and looked down upon the reclining figure of the man who had oft been called the most dangerous enemy of Republican France. Of a truth, a fine figure of a man. Chauvelin was ready enough to admit that. The long, hard limbs, the wide chest and slender white hands, all bespoke the man of birth, breeding and energy. The face looked too strong and clearly cut in repose, now that the perpetually inane smile did not play around the firm lips, nor the lazy, indolent expression mar the seriousness of the straight brow. For one moment—it was a mere flash—Chauvelin felt almost sorry that so interesting a career should be thus ignominiously brought to a close. The terrorist felt that if his own future, his own honour and integrity, were about to be so hopelessly crushed, he would have wandered up and down this narrow room like a caged beast, eating out his heart with self-reproach and remorse, and racking his nerves and brain for an issue out of the terrible alternative which meant dishonour or death. But this man drank and slept. Perhaps he doesn't care. And as if in answer to Chauvelin's puzzled musing, a deep snore escaped the sleeping adventurer's parted lips. Chauvelin sighed, perplexed and troubled. He looked around the little room, then went up to a small side table which stood against the wall, and on which were two or three quill pens and an inkwell, also some loosely scattered sheets of paper. These he turned over with a careless hand, and presently came across a closely written page. "Citizen Chauvelin, in consideration of a further sum of 1,000,000 francs." It was the beginning of the letter. Only a few words so far, with several corrections of misspelt words, and a line left out here and there which confused the meaning. A beginning made by the unsteady hand of that drunken fool. An attempt only at present. But still, a beginning. Close by was the draft of it as written out by Chauvelin, and which Sir Percy had evidently begun to copy. He had made up his mind, then. He meant to subscribe with his own hand to his lasting dishonour, and meaning it, he slept. Chauvelin felt the paper trembling in his hand. He felt strangely agitated and nervous now that the issue was so near, so sure.
"There's no demmed hurry for that, is there, Monsieur Chaubertin?"
came from the slowly wakening Sir Percy in somewhat thick, heavy accents, accompanied by a prolonged yawn.
I haven't got the demmed thing quite ready."
Chauvelin had been so startled that the paper dropped from his hand. He stooped to pick it up.
"Nay, why should you be so scared, sir?" continued Sir Percy lazily. "Did you think I was drunk? I assure you, sir, on my honour, I am not so drunk as you think I am."
"I have no doubt, Sir Percy," replied Chauvelin ironically, "that you have all your marvellous faculties entirely at your command. I must apologise for disturbing your papers," he added, replacing the half-written page on the table. "I thought perhaps that if the letter was ready..."
"It will be, sir, it will be, for I am not drunk, I assure you, and can write with a steady hand and do honour to my signature.
When will you have the letter ready, Sir Percy?"
"The Daydream must leave the harbour at the turn of the tide," quoth Sir Percy thickly. "It'll be demmed well time by then, won't it, sir?"
"About sundown, Sir Percy, not later?"
"About sundown, not later,"
muttered Blakeney as he once more stretched his long limbs along the narrow bed.
He gave a long and hearty yawn. "I'll not fail you," he murmured as he closed his eyes and gave a final struggle to get his head at a comfortable angle. "The letter will be written in my best Lud, but I'm not so drunk as you think I am."
But as if to belie his own oft-repeated assertion, hardly was the last word out of his mouth than his stertorous and even breathing proclaimed the fact that he was once more fast asleep. With a shrug of the shoulders and a look of unutterable contempt at his broken-down enemy, Chauvelin turned on his heels and went out of the room. But outside in the corridor he called the orderly to him and gave strict commands that no more wine or brandy was to be served to the Englishman under any circumstances whatever. "He has 2 hours in which to sleep off the effects of all that brandy he had consumed," he mused as he finally went back to his own quarters, "and by that time he will be able to write with a steady hand." End of chapter 32. Chapter 33 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in March 2008. Chapter 33. The English Spy. And now at last the shades of evening were drawing in thick and fast. Within the walls of Fort Gayole the last rays of the setting sun had long ago ceased to shed their dying radiance, and through the thick stone embrasures and the dusty panes of glass the grey light of dusk soon failed to penetrate. In the large ground-floor room with its window opened upon the wide promenade of the southern ramparts, a silence reigned which was oppressive. The air was heavy with the fumes of the 2 tallow candles on the table, which smoked persistently. Against the walls a row of figures, in dark blue uniforms with scarlet facings, drab breeches and heavy riding boots, silent and immovable, with fixed bayonets, like so many automatons lining the room all around. At some little distance from the central table, and out of the immediate circle of the light, a small group composed of 5 soldiers in the same blue and scarlet uniforms. One of these was Sergeant Hebert. In the centre of this group 2 persons were sitting, a woman and an old man. The Abbé Fouquet had been brought down from his prison cell a few minutes ago, and told to watch what would go on round him, after which he would be allowed to go to his old church of St. Joseph and ring the Angelus once more before he and his family left Boulogne forever. The Angelus would be the signal for the opening of all the prison gates in the town. Everyone tonight would come and go as they pleased, and having rung the Angelus, the Abbé would be at liberty to join François and Félicité and their old mother, his sister, outside the purlieus of the town. The Abbé Fouquet did not quite understand all this, which was very rapidly and roughly explained to him. It was such a very little while ago that he had expected to see the innocent children mounting up those awful steps which led to the guillotine, whilst he himself was looking death quite near in the face, that all this talk of amnesty and of pardon had not quite fully reached his brain. But he was quite content that it had all been ordained by le bon Dieu, and very happy at the thought of ringing the dearly loved Angelus in his own old church once again. So when he was peremptorily pushed into the room and found himself close to Marguerite, with 4 or 5 soldiers standing round them, he quietly pulled his old rosary from his pocket and began murmuring gentle paters and aves under his breath. Beside him sat Marguerite, rigid as a statue, her cloak thrown over her shoulders so that its hood might hide her face. She could not now have said how that awful day had passed, how she had managed to survive the terrible, nerve-racking suspense, the agonizing doubt as to what was going to happen. But above all, what she had found most unendurable was the torturing thought that in this same grim and frowning building her husband was there, somewhere, how far or how near she could not say. But she knew that she was parted from him, and perhaps would not see him again, not even at the hour of death. That Percy would never write that infamous letter and live, she knew. That he might write it in order to save her, she feared was possible, whilst the look of triumph on Chauvelin's face had aroused her most agonizing terrors. When she was summarily ordered to go into the next room, she realized at once that all hope was now more than futile. The walls lined with troops, the attitude of her enemies, and above all that table with paper, ink, and pens ready, as it were, for the accomplishment of that hideous and monstrous deed, all made her very heart numb, as if it were held within the chill embrace of death. "If the woman moves, speaks, or screams, gag her at once," said Collot roughly the moment she sat down, and Sergeant Hebert stood over her, gag and cloth in hand, whilst two soldiers placed heavy hands on her shoulders. But she neither moved nor spoke, not even presently when a loud and cheerful voice came echoing from a distant corridor, and anon the door opened and her husband came in, accompanied by Chauvelin. The ex-ambassador was very obviously in a state of acute nervous tension. His hands were tightly clasped behind his back, and his movements were curiously irresponsible and jerky. But Sir Percy Blakeney looked a picture of calm unconcern. The lace bow at his throat was tied with scrupulous care, his eyeglass upheld at quite the correct angle, and his delicate-coloured caped coat was thrown back just sufficiently to afford a glimpse of the dainty cloth suit and exquisitely embroidered waistcoat beneath. He was the perfect presentation of a London dandy, and might have been entering a royal drawing-room in company with an honoured guest. Marguerite's eyes were riveted on him as he came well within the circle of light projected by the candles, but not even with that acute sixth sense of a passionate and loving woman could she detect the slightest tremor in the aristocratic hands which held the gold-rimmed eyeglass, nor the faintest quiver of the firmly moulded lips. This had occurred just as the bell of the old Beffroi chimed 6:15. Now it was close on 7, and in the centre of the room, and with his face and figure well lighted up by the candles, at the table, pen in hand, sat Sir Percy writing. At his elbow, just behind him, stood Chauvelin on the one side, and Collot d'Herbois on the other, both watching with fixed and burning eyes the writing of that letter. Sir Percy seemed in no hurry. He wrote slowly and deliberately, carefully copying the draft of the letter which was propped up in front of him. The spelling of some of the French words seemed to have troubled him at first, for when he began he made many facetious and self-deprecatory remarks anent his own want of education, and carelessness in youth in acquiring the gentle art of speaking so elegant a language. Presently, however, he appeared more at his ease, or perhaps less inclined to talk, since he only received curt monosyllabic answers to his pleasant sallies. 5 minutes had gone by without any other sound, save the spasmodic creak of Sir Percy's pen upon the paper, the while Chauvelin and Collot watched every word he wrote. But gradually from afar there had risen in the stillness of the evening a distant rolling noise like that of surf breaking against the cliffs. Nearer and louder it grew, and as it increased in volume, so it gained now in diversity. The monotonous roll-like far-off thunder was just as continuous as before, but now shriller notes broke out from amongst the more remote sounds. A loud laugh seemed ever and anon to pierce the distance and to rise above the persistent hubbub, which became the mere accompaniment to these isolated tones. The merrymakers of Boulogne, having started from the Place de la Sénéchaussée, were making the round of the town by the wide avenue which tops the ramparts. They were coming past the Fort Gaillol, shouting, singing, brass trumpets in the front, big drum ahead, drenched, hot, and hoarse, but supremely happy. Sir Percy looked up for a moment as the noise drew nearer, then turned to Chauvelin and pointing to the letter, he said, "I have nearly finished." The suspense in the smoke-laden atmosphere of this room was becoming unendurable, and 4 hearts at least were beating wildly with overpowering anxiety. Marguerite's eyes were fixed with tender intensity on the man she so passionately loved. She did not understand his actions or his motives, but she felt a wild longing in her to drink in every line of that loved face, as if with this last long look she was bidding an eternal farewell to all hopes of future earthly happiness. The old priest had ceased to tell his beads. Feeling in his kindly heart the echo of the appalling tragedy which was being enacted before him, he had put out a fatherly, tentative hand towards Marguerite, and given her icy fingers a comforting pressure. And in the hearts of Chauvelin and his colleague there was satisfied revenge, eager, exultant triumph, and that terrible nerve-tension which immediately precedes the long-expected climax. But who can say what went on within the heart of that bold adventurer, about to be brought to the lowest depths of humiliation which it is in the power of man to endure? What behind that smooth, unruffled brow still bent laboriously over the page of writing? The crowd was now on the Place d'Aumont. Some of the foremost in the ranks were ascending the stone steps which led to the southern ramparts. The noise had become incessant. Pierrot and Pierrettes, Harlequins and Columbines, had worked themselves up into a veritable intoxication of shouts and laughter. Now, as they all swarmed up the steps and caught sight of the open window, almost on a level with the ground, and of the large, dimly lighted room, they gave forth one terrific and voluminous hurrah for the paternal government in Paris, who had given them cause for all this joy. Then they recollected how the amnesty, the pardon, the national fete, this brilliant procession had come about, and somebody in the crowd shouted, "Allons, let us have a look at that English spy. Let us see the Scarlet Pimpernel. Yes, yes, let us see what he is like." They shouted and stamped and swarmed round the open window, swinging their lanterns and demanding in a loud tone of voice that the English spy be shown to them. Faces wet with rain and perspiration tried to peep in at the window. Collot gave brief orders to the soldiers to close the shutters at once and to push away the crowd. But the crowd would not be pushed, it would not be gainsaid, and when the soldiers tried to close the window, 20 angry fists broke the panes of glass. "I can't finish this writing in your lingo, sir, whilst this demmed row is going on," said Sir Percy placidly. "You have not much more to write, Sir Percy," urged Chauvelin with nervous impatience. "I pray you finish the matter now and get you gone from out this city." "Send that demmed lot away, then," rejoined Sir Percy calmly. "They won't go. They want to see you." Sir Percy paused a moment, pen in hand, as if in deep reflection. "They want to see me," he said with a laugh. "Why, demm it all, then why not let 'em?" And with a few rapid strokes of the pen he quickly finished the letter, adding his signature with a bold flourish, whilst the crowd, pushing, jostling, shouting and cursing the soldiers, still loudly demanded to see the Scarlet Pimpernel. Chauvelin felt as if his heart would veritably burst with the wildness of its beating. Then Sir Percy, with one hand lightly pressed on the letter, pushed his chair away and with his pleasant ringing voice said once again, "Well, demm it, let him see me." With that he sprang to his feet and up to his full height, and as he did so he seized the two massive pewter candlesticks, one in each hand, and with powerful arms well outstretched he held them high above his head. "The letter!" murmured Chauvelin in a hoarse whisper. But even as he was quickly reaching out a hand, which shook with the intensity of his excitement, towards the letter on the table, Blakeney, with one loud and sudden shout, threw the heavy candlesticks onto the floor. They rattled down with a terrific crash, the lights were extinguished, and the whole room was immediately plunged in utter darkness. The crowd gave a wild yell of fear. They had only caught sight for one instant of that gigantic figure, which, with arms outstretched, had seemed supernaturally tall, weirdly illumined by the flickering light of the tallow candles, and the next moment disappearing into utter darkness before their very gaze. Overcome with sudden superstitious fear, Pierrot and Pierrettes, drummer and trumpeters, turned and fled in every direction. Within the room all was wild confusion. The soldiers heard a cry, "La fenêtre! La fenêtre!" Who gave it, no one knew. No one could afterwards recollect. Certain it is that with one accord the majority of the men made a rush for the open window, driven thither partly by the wild instinct of the chase after an escaping enemy, and partly by the same superstitious terror which had caused the crowd to flee. They clambered over the sill and dropped down onto the ramparts below, then started in wild pursuit. But when the crash came, Chauvelin had given one frantic shout, "The letter! Collot! A moi! In his hand, the letter!" There was the sound of a heavy thud, of a terrible scuffle there on the floor in the darkness, and then a yell of victory from Collot d'Herbois. "I have the letter! À Paris!" "Victory!" echoed Chauvelin, exultant and panting. "Victory! The Angelus, friend Hébert! Take the calotin to ring the Angelus!" It was instinct which caused Collot d'Herbois to find the door. He tore it open, letting in a feeble ray of light from the corridor. He stood in the doorway one moment, his slouchy, ungainly form distinctly outlined against the lighter background beyond, a look of exultant and malicious triumph, of deadly hate and cruelty distinctly imprinted on his face, and with upraised hand wildly flourishing the precious document, the brand of dishonour for the enemy of France. "À Paris!" shouted Chauvelin to him excitedly, "into Robespierre's hands, the letter!" Then he fell back panting, exhausted, on the nearest chair. Collot, without looking again behind him, called wildly for the men who were to escort him to Paris. They were picked troopers, stalwart veterans from the old municipal guard. They had not broken their ranks throughout the turmoil, and fell into line in perfect order as they followed Citizen Collot out of the room. Less than 5 minutes later there was the noise of stamping and champing of bits in the courtyard below, a shout from Collot, and the sound of a cavalcade galloping at breakneck speed towards the distant Paris gate. End of chapter 33. Chapter 34 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage, in March 2008. Chapter 34. The Angelus. And gradually all noises died away around the old Fort Gayol. The shouts and laughter of the merrymakers, who had quickly recovered from their fright, now came only as the muffled rumble of a distant storm, broken here and there by the shrill note of a girl's loud laughter, or a vigorous fanfare from the brass trumpets. The room where so much turmoil had taken place, where so many hearts had beaten with torrent-like emotions, where the awesome tragedy of revenge and hate, of love and passion had been consummated, was now silent and at peace. The soldiers had gone, some in pursuit of the revellers, some with Collot d'Herbois, others with Hébert and the calotin who was to ring the Angelus. Chauvelin, overcome with the intensity of his exaltation and the agony of the suspense which he had endured, sat vaguely dreaming, hardly conscious, but wholly happy and content. Fearless, too, for his triumph was complete, and he cared not now if he lived or died. He had lived long enough to see the complete annihilation and dishonour of his enemy. What had happened to Sir Percy Blakeney now, what to Marguerite, he neither knew nor cared. No doubt the Englishman had picked himself up and got away through the window or the door. He would be anxious to get his wife out of the town as quickly as possible. The Angelus would ring directly, the gates would be opened, the harbour made free to everyone. And Collot was a league outside Boulogne by now, a league nearer to Paris. So what mattered the humbled wayside English flower, the damaged and withered Scarlet Pimpernel? A slight noise suddenly caused him to start. He had been dreaming, no doubt, having fallen into some kind of torpor, akin to sleep, after the deadly and restless fatigue of the past 4 days. He certainly had been unconscious of everything around him, of time and of place, but now he felt fully awake. And again he heard that slight noise, as if something or someone was moving in the room. He tried to peer into the darkness, but could distinguish nothing. He rose and went to the door. It was still open, and close behind it, against the wall, a small oil lamp was fixed which lit up the corridor. Chauvelin detached the lamp and came back with it into the room. Just as he did so, there came to his ears the first sound of the little church bell ringing the Angelus. He stepped into the room, holding the lamp high above his head. Its feeble rays fell full upon the brilliant figure of Sir Percy Blakeney. He was smiling pleasantly, bowing slightly towards Chauvelin, and in his hand he held the sheathed sword, the blade of which had been fashioned in Toledo for Lorenzo Cenci, and the fellow of which was lying now, Chauvelin himself knew not where. "The day and hour, monsieur, I think," said Sir Percy with courtly grace, "when you and I are to cross swords together. Those are the southern ramparts, meseems. Will you proceed, sir, and I will follow." At sight of this man, of his impudence and of his daring, Chauvelin felt an icy grip on his heart. His cheeks became ashen white, his thin lips closed with a snap, and the hand which held the lamp aloft trembled visibly. Sir Percy stood before him, still smiling, and with a graceful gesture pointing towards the ramparts. From the church of St. Joseph the gentle, melancholy tones of the Angelus sounding the second Ave Maria came faintly echoing in the evening air. With a violent effort, Chauvelin forced himself to self-control, and tried to shake off the strange feeling of obsession which had overwhelmed him in the presence of this extraordinary man. He walked quite quietly up to the table, and placed the lamp upon it. As in a flash of recollection had come back to him the past few minutes, the letter, and Collot well on his way to Paris. Bah! He had nothing to fear now, save perhaps death at the hand of this adventurer turned assassin in his misery and humiliation. "A truce on this folly, Sir Percy," he said roughly. "As you well know, I had never any intention of fighting you with these poisoned swords of yours, and I knew that, Monsieur Chauvelin. But do you know that I have the intention of killing you now, as you stand, like a dog?" And throwing down the sword with one of those uncontrolled outbursts of almost animal passion, which for one instant revealed the real inner man, he went up to Chauvelin, and towering above him like a great avenging giant, he savoured for one second the joy of looking down on that puny, slender figure which he could crush with sheer brute force with one blow from his powerful hands. But Chauvelin at this moment was beyond fear. "And if you killed me now, Sir Percy," he said quietly, and looking at the man whom he so hated fully in the eyes, "you could not destroy that letter which my colleague is taking to Paris at this very moment." As he had anticipated, his words seemed to change Sir Percy's mood in an instant. The passion in the handsome, aristocratic face faded in a trice, the hard lines around the jaw and lips relaxed, the fire of revenge died out from the lazy blue eyes, and the next moment a long, loud, merry laugh raised the dormant echoes of the old fort.
"Nay, Monsieur Chaubertin," said Sir Percy gaily, "but this is marvellous, demmed marvellous. Do you hear that, my dear? Gadzooks, but 'tis the best joke I have heard this past 12 months. Monsieur here thinks, lud, but I shall die of laughing. Monsieur here thinks that 'twas that demmed letter which went to Paris, and that an English gentleman lay scuffling on the floor and allowed a letter to be filched from him."
"Sir Percy!" gasped Chauvelin, as an awful thought seemed suddenly to flash across his fevered brain.
"Lud, sir, you are astonishing," said Sir Percy, taking a very much crumpled sheet of paper from the capacious pocket of his elegant caped coat, and holding it close to Chauvelin's horror-stricken gaze. "This is the letter which I wrote at that table yonder in order to gain time, and in order to fool you. But by the Lord, you are a bigger demmed fool than I ever took you to be, if you thought it would serve any other purpose than that of my hitting you in the face with it." And with a quick and violent gesture, he struck Chauvelin full in the face with the paper. "You would like to know, Monsieur Chaubertin, would you not?" he added pleasantly, "what letter it is that your friend, Citizen Collot, is taking in such hot haste to Paris for you? Well, the letter is not long, and 'tis written in verse. I wrote it myself upstairs to-day, whilst you thought me sodden with brandy and three parts asleep. But brandy is easily flung out of the window. Did you think I drank it all? Nay, as you remember, I told you that I was not so drunk as you thought. Aye, the letter is written in English verse, monsieur, and it reads thus. We seek him here, we seek him there. Those Frenchies seek him everywhere. Is he in heaven? Is he in hell? That demmed elusive Pimpernel. A neat rhyme, I fancy, monsieur, and one which will, if rightly translated, greatly please your friend and ruler, Citizen Robespierre. Your colleague, Citizen Collot, is well on his way to Paris with it by now. No, no, monsieur, as you rightly said just now, I really could not kill you, God having blessed me with a saving sense of humour. Even as he spoke, the third Ave Maria of the Angelus died away on the morning air. From the harbour, the old chateau, there came the loud boom of cannon. The hour of the opening of the gates, of the general amnesty and free harbour, was announced throughout Boulogne. Chauvelin was livid with rage, fear, and baffled revenge. He made a sudden rush for the door in a blind desire to call for help, but Sir Percy had toyed long enough with his prey. The hour was speeding on. Hébert and some of the soldiers might return, and it was time to think of safety and of flight. Quick as a hunted panther, he had interposed his tall figure between his enemy and the latter's chance of calling for aid. Then, seizing the little man by the shoulders, he pushed him back into that portion of the room where Marguerite and the Abbé Fouquet had lately been sitting. The gag, with cloth and cord, which had been intended for a woman, were lying on the ground close by, just where Hébert had dropped them when he marched the old abbé off to the church. With quick and dexterous hands, Sir Percy soon reduced Chauvelin to an impotent and silent bundle. The ex-ambassador, after 4 days of harrowing nerve tension followed by so awful a climax, was weakened physically and mentally, whilst Blakeney, powerful, athletic, and always absolutely unperturbed, was fresh in body and spirit. He had slept calmly all the afternoon, having quietly thought out all his plans, left nothing to chance, and acted methodically and quickly, and invariably with perfect repose. Having fully assured himself that the cords were well fastened, the gag secure, and Chauvelin completely helpless, he took the now inert mass up in his arms and carried it into the adjoining room, where Marguerite for 12 hours had endured a terrible martyrdom. He laid his enemy's helpless form upon the couch, and for one moment looked down on it with a strange feeling of pity quite unmixed with contempt. The light from the lamp in the further room struck vaguely upon the prostrate figure of Chauvelin. He seemed to have lost consciousness, for the eyes were closed. Only the hands, which were tied securely to his body, had a spasmodic, nervous twitch in them. With a good-natured shrug of the shoulders, the imperturbable Sir Percy turned to go, but just before he did so, he took a scrap of paper from his waistcoat pocket and slipped it between Chauvelin's trembling fingers. On the paper were scribbled the 4 lines of verse which in the next 4 and 20 hours Robespierre himself and his colleagues would read. Then Blakeney finally went out of the room. End of chapter 34. Chapter 35 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi. Read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in March 2008. Chapter 35. Marguerite. As he re-entered the large room, she was standing beside the table, with one dainty hand resting against the back of the chair, her whole graceful figure bent forward as if in an agony of ardent expectation. Never for an instant, in that supreme moment when his precious life was at stake, did she waver in courage or presence of mind. From the moment that he jumped up and took the candlesticks in his hands, her sixth sense showed her as in a flash what he meant to do, and how he would wish her to act.
When the room was plunged in darkness, she stood absolutely still. When she heard the scuffle on the floor, she never trembled, for her passionate heart had already told her that he never meant to deliver that infamous letter into his enemy's hands. Then, when there was the general scramble, when the soldiers rushed away, when the room became empty and Chauvelin alone remained, she shrank quietly into the darkest corner of the room, hardly breathing, only waiting, waiting for a sign from him. She could not see him, but she felt the beloved presence there, somewhere close to her, and she knew that he would wish her to wait. She watched him silently, ready to help if he called, equally ready to remain still and to wait. Only when the helpless body of her deadly enemy was well out of the way did she come out from the darkness, and now she stood with the full light of the lamp illumining her ruddy golden hair, the delicate blush on her cheek, the flame of love dancing in her glorious eyes. Thus he saw her as he re-entered the room, and for one second he paused at the door, for the joy of seeing her there seemed greater than he could bear. Forgotten was the agony of mind which he had endured, the humiliations and the dangers which still threatened. He only remembered that she loved him, and that he worshipped her. The next moment she lay clasped in his arms. All was still around them, save for the gentle patter-patter of the rain on the trees of the ramparts, and from very far away the echo of laughter and music from the distant revellers, and then the cry of the sea-mew thrice repeated from just beneath the window. Blakeney and Marguerite awoke from their brief dream. Once more the passionate lover gave place to the man of action. "'Tis Tony, and I mistake not," he said hurriedly, as with loving fingers still slightly trembling with suppressed passion, he readjusted the hood over her head. "'Lord Tony,' she murmured. "'Aye, with Hastings and one or two others. I told them to be ready for us tonight as soon as the place was quiet.' "'You were so sure of success, then, Percy?' she asked in wonderment. "'So sure,' he replied simply. Then he led her to the window and lifted her on to the sill. It was not high from the ground, and two pairs of willing arms were there ready to help her down. Then he too followed, and quietly the little party turned to walk toward the gate. The ramparts themselves now looked strangely still and silent. The merrymakers were far away. Only one or two passers-by hurried swiftly past here and there, carrying bundles, evidently bent on making use of that welcome permission to leave this dangerous soil. The little party walked on in silence, Marguerite's small hand resting on her husband's arm. Anon they came upon a group of soldiers who were standing somewhat perfunctorily and irresolutely close by the open gate of the fort. "'Tiens, c'est l'anglais,' said one. "'Morbleu, he is on his way back to England,' commented another lazily. The gates of Boulogne had been thrown open to everyone when the Angelus was rung and the cannon boomed. The general amnesty had been proclaimed. Everyone had the right to come and go as they pleased. The sentinels had been ordered to challenge no one and to let everyone pass. No one knew that the great and glorious plans for the complete annihilation of the Scarlet Pimpernel and his League had come to naught, that Collot was taking a mighty hoax to Paris, and that the man who had thought out and nearly carried through the most fiendishly cruel plan ever conceived for the destruction of an enemy lay helpless, bound and gagged, within his own stronghold. And so the little party, consisting of Sir Percy and Marguerite, Lord Antony Dewhurst and my Lord Hastings, passed unchallenged through the gates of Boulogne. Outside the precincts of the town they met my Lord Everingham and Sir Philip Glynde, who had met the Abbé Fouquet outside his little church, and escorted him safely out of the city, whilst François and Félicité, with their old mother, had been under the charge of other members of the League. "'We were all in the procession, dressed up in all sorts of ragged finery until the last moment,' explained Lord Tony to Marguerite, as the entire party now quickly made its way to the harbour. "'We did not know what was going to happen. All we knew was that we should be wanted about this time.' The hour when the duel was to have been fought, and somewhere near here on the southern ramparts, and we always have strict orders to mix with the crowd if there happens to be one. When we saw Blakeney raise the candlesticks, we guessed what was coming, and we each went to our respective posts. It was all quite simple. The young man spoke gaily and lightly, but through the easy banter of his tone there pierced the enthusiasm and pride of the soldier in the glory and daring of his chief. Between the city walls and the harbour there was much bustle and agitation. The English packet-boat would lift anchor at the turn of the tide, and as everyone was free to get aboard without leave or passport, there was a very large number of passengers bound for the land of freedom. Two boats from the Daydream were waiting in readiness for Sir Percy and my lady and those whom they would bring with them. Silently the party embarked, and as the boats pushed off and the sailors from Sir Percy's yacht bent to their oars, the old Abbé Fouquet began gently droning a pater and ave to the accompaniment of his beads. He accepted joy, happiness, and safety with the same gentle philosophy as he would have accepted death. But Marguerite's keen and loving ears caught at the end of each pater a gently murmured request to le bon Dieu to bless and protect our English rescuer. Only once did Marguerite make allusion to that terrible time which had become the past. They were wandering together down the chestnut alley in the beautiful garden at Richmond. It was evening, and the air was heavy with the rich odour of wet earth, of belated roses, and dying mignonette. She had paused in the alley and placed a trembling hand upon his arm, whilst raising her eyes filled with tears of tender passion up to his face. "Percy," she murmured, "have you forgiven me?"
"What, my dear?"
"That awful evening in Boulogne, what that fiend demanded, his awful either-or. I brought it all upon you, it was all my fault."
"Nay, my dear, for that 'tis I should thank you."
"Thank me?"
"Aye,"
he said, whilst in the fast gathering dusk she could only just perceive the sudden hardening of his face, the look of wild passion in his eyes. "But for that evening in Boulogne, but for that alternative which that devil placed before me, I might never have known how much you meant to me." Even the recollection of all the sorrow, the anxiety, the torturing humiliations of that night seemed completely to change him. The voice became trenchant, the hands were tightly clenched, but Marguerite drew nearer to him. Her two hands were on his breast. She murmured gently, "And now?" He folded her in his arms, with an agony of joy, and said earnestly, "Now I know." End of chapter 35. End of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.